Bell. It was already 11 o'clock at night, and I walked home, and there's a British Army truck standing in front of our new apartment there, with one of these with these camouflage canvas over it. And as I tried to go around it, around the back towards my front door, a voice comes out from under the canvas. A woman's voice that says, "Oh, sir, would you know where the Lessings live?" It's the voice of my mother, and I could barely answer. "Mom, it's me, it's Eddie." As she jumped up this truck, she says, "Oh my God, it's my son, Eddie. How come you're so big?" I said, "Mom, I'm 19 years old." And she was back. And very soon after that, we emigrated all to the, emigrated to the United States. My parents moved to Springfield, Massachusetts. My father and I first went ahead, and my father started teaching music in Springfield, and I got a job with General Electric in East Schenectady, New York. And my girlfriend and I, from the Zionist Party, kept on writing letters to each other, and she was going to come over. And let's see what's relevant here.
The fact of the matter is that all members of your family survived. You and your brothers.
Everyone survived, which is a miracle. That is true. Because by that time, we began to discover that 80% of Holland's Jewry had been destroyed. My uncle, Joseph, my father's brother, with his wife, and my little cousin, Jackie, been sent to the gas chambers. Two aunts had been gassed. A whole slew of people. We just wanted to get the hell out of Europe. And I wanted to go to Palestine, but my parents said, "Listen, we got a visa for the United States. Go to America. You can still go from there to Palestine." Okay. My girlfriend came over a year later. We got married in Massachusetts. And in 1950, we boarded the SS LaGuardia in New York Harbor and sailed to Haifa in the two-year-old Nation of Israel. And we went to a kibbutz where Carlos, my wife's brother, lived with his wife. And so we became kibbutzniks. We were members of a kibbutz for 5 years. I worked on tractors and plowing and seeding and harvesting, and my wife Carla worked in children's houses growing the new first crop of Israeli babies. And my daughter was born there. My daughter Noah, N-O-A, Noah, was born there. And 5 years later, we went back. We came here. Came back to the States. 1956, actually, we were back in the States. I started to work, and my wife started going to school to become a social worker. We had a son, and life went on. My wife had downstairs in this house shelves of Holocaust literature. I never touched it. It was like a grenades flying there. If I would touch them, they would explode. Comes the year of 1991, and my wife and two other women are wondering if it wouldn't be possible to have a little conference of child survivors. Because Holocaust survivors were people who had been in concentration camps.
Right.
Nobody looked at us and said, "Hey, you're survivors too." And so my wife and two others set up this little scheme to have a little conference for child survivors who had escaped death. And they thought it would be a couple of hundred people. They rented, gave special rates for the Marriott Marquis on Times Square. That's where it was going to be. And my wife says to me, "Are you coming to the conference?" I said, "Nah, what am I supposed to do there?" She said, "Well, it's a little strange. I'm one of the organizers. You're also a survivor, you know, child survivor. And my brother especially coming from Israel for this conference. You should really come." I saw, being a good husband, I said, all right, I'll come, you know. Comes conference, I think it was Friday night. The conference was to be from Friday night, first dinner, to Monday morning. And I'm at the Marriott Marquis, and I'm on the 7th floor, I think, where people are supposed to get their kit, you know. And I'm standing to see these glass elevators and coming up with these gray-haired, silver-haired people coming up. And they're walking over to that place where they get a bag with the said child volumes. Something else had happened in the meantime, but I should really mention here, en passant, as they say in French. And I'm watching the people go into that thing. And I thought, I wonder who these people are, you know? Listen to this. I wonder who these people are. So they get their kit, they get name tags, they put the name tags on, and they stand around. Some people hug, they seem to find long lost friends or something, they hug, and some people cry. I thought, gee, it's interesting, I wonder who these people are. I should sort of work my weasel my way up to one of these little circles of people, and I gotta watch out because here I usually break down. I read their name tags. It says, "I was hidden in Romania. I was hidden in France. I was hidden in Belgium. I was hidden in Holland." I burst out crying.
That's okay.
I cried for 3 days. I listened to the speeches. Abe Foxman, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, who was a child, spoke, and I cried, and others, and I cried and cried and cried. And on Sunday, what was it, Monday, in a heavy thunderstorm, I drove the car out of the garage downstairs on our way back home here. And I felt as if I had lost 16 of those brothers and sisters. Total change in my life. Went home, started reading all those goddamn books and all the shelves there. A little later I started, people said, "Gee, you have some kind of story, you know. Why don't you tell it?" You know? I said, I don't know if I can tell this. So I made notes. I started to speak here and there, and geez, I found out I'm a pretty good speaker. After a while, I spoke without notes. I made these boards with photographs and set up a whole routine, and now it's a set piece by now. Now, we come to 1992. Would you like me to tell you about
this?
Because it really belongs with my Holocaust story.
Sure, please do.
In 1992, there's an organization is set up in Amsterdam to have a conference of the army, hidden children in Dutch hidden children. And so my wife and I, of course, planning to go. And I write a letter to Hall, to the policeman who saved my life.
He's still alive.
I don't know. I write a letter. Didn't even know his address or something, but I wrote it to the War Documentation Bureau. And I get a letter back that says, Mr. Lessing, we're sorry. His name was Oskam, O-S-K-A-M was his family name. Officer Oskam has died, and his wife has died, but we've sent your letter on to his son, Oskam Jr. And I get a letter from Oskam Jr., who was 4 years old when the war ended. And said, Mr. Lessing, I don't know who you are, but when you come to Holland for the conference, come and see me. So the day after we landed, oh, by the way, I should tell you this. We're in the plane, KLM plane, flying to Amsterdam. We're about 10, 15 minutes away from landing in Schiphol Airport. And the captain comes on, like they always do, and says, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for flying KLM. We'll be landing at Schiphol Airport in a few minutes. And, have a fairly good trip. And I burst out crying.
It's the first time you've been back to Holland since?
Yes. I'm sobbing sitting next to my wife. She said, what are you crying for? I said, this is crazy. I said, when this plane lands, I see at the end of the runway, there's a line of black trucks with SS waiting for me. She said, you know, it's 1992. I said, I know. I just saw it. That morning of the raid, when my buddy and I ran away and vanished, saw the German, that has become the center of really my worst fears and Holocaust experience, of course. That was so close to death that, anyway, we land, and of course there's my cousin with her little blue Honda, and it's 1992, and next day we go to Oskam Jr. He is totally different from his father, who later on I'll show you their pictures. He has round cheeks, and he's a very, very jolly man, and he's a retired plumber. Of course, when I say this, in the schools, somehow this always evokes a laugh. I have no idea why, but I said, and he was a retired plumber. Yay! And he said, he lives in a tiny little Dutch house, and his wife and his daughter is there. And, what can I do for you, Mr. Lessing? I said, did you know there was a hut in the woods? He said, yes, I know. My father was arrested the day of the raid. He was taken to Amsterdam by the Gestapo, and he was beaten up. But they didn't realize they found him with his service revolver. They didn't know he was a policeman. And beat the hell out of him because they found out that he was entitled to carry it anyway. Oskam was badly damaged. Came back 3 weeks later from Amsterdam from the Gestapo and never was the same really. But he said. But I said, well, did you know who was in that hut? He said, no, I don't know. I was 4 years old when the war ended. And my father wasn't a very talkative man. I said, I know, but. I said, did you know I was in the hut? He said, no. He said, what? Mr. Lessing, why are you asking me all these questions? I said, I thought if there were maybe still a sister or a brother of the man with whom I lived in the hut, the men who were all killed by the Germans, I thought I could maybe talk with them and tell them a little bit of that last morning or maybe the last days that we were together. And he's listening, and he said, he interrupts me, he said, Mr. Lessing, there's something wrong with your story. I thought, what the hell would he know? He was 4 years old. I said, well, what? He said, Mr. Lessing, I don't know much what happened there that morning of the raid, but one thing I know, no one was arrested. They all escaped because some people came to warn them. Holy cow, I find out 50 years after the war that I tell the kids in schools a lot about rescuers, that this is the one good thing that came out of the Holocaust, the rescuers. And I find I'm a little bit of a rescuer myself now with my buddy. We came to warn them, we didn't run away. We could have been shot while running away. But so I said, did you know who they were? He didn't know who they were. All he knew was they had survived. So we get outside, it was wonderful. Oscar Jr. and I, we decided, and my wife was there also, Carla was there. And said, after the conference is over, we'll go to the place where the hut wants to. And so that was it. And so we come outside in my cousin's little Honda, and she says, I wasn't in there. I said, I'm shocked. I found out that all the men who I thought had been killed survived, and they may be living for all I know, but it's 50 years ago, of course. And my cousin says, you know, there's a radio program here in Holland. It's called Address Unknown. People go on there, they tell the story, and people can call in. It's a call-in program, telephone call-in. And maybe you can go on there and tell your story. I said, Lois, it's 50 years ago, a bunch of guys in a hut in the woods, who the hell would still know? She said, well, I don't know, try it. Call the Catholic radio center and where that program is broadcast every Friday morning. And I got a lady on the phone and I tell my little bit of my story, like I've been telling you. And are we still okay?
Yeah, we're fine. Keep it.
And she says, are you going, Mr. Lessing, are you going to be here for the next 3 months? I said, no, I have to go back, you know, to the States. I said, I'm a graphics designer. I have to go back to work. And okay, she says, I'm sorry. All right. We go to the conference. We come out of the conference as my cousin again, always with a little blue Honda, and says, call the radio station. They've been calling day and night to talk with you. Okay, so I called the radio station and they said, Mr. Lessing, we found what you told us so interesting. We have made a spot for you. We'll please come next Friday morning to be interviewed on Address Unknown. My famous interviewer in Holland, Hans van Willigenburg, is sort of a David Letterman of J. O. Weeps.
Mm-hmm.
And there I am. I said, what a waste of time. On Friday morning early, Carl and I worked in studio, and on the way I said, what a waste of time. Who would know anything about 50 years ago somewhere in the woods and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I get on there. The interviewer is a nice guy. I have all kinds of photographs of all this stuff if you're interested. And he interviews me. I tell him, raid on the hut, this and that. And he said, what happened to the man? I said, well, I just found out that they didn't die as I thought. Oh, he said, that's very interesting, Mr. Lessing. Let's see what messages come in. And what they do there, every message gets written on a slip of paper. And I get, and when the interview part is over, I go backstage with him and there's a dozen phones and they're ringing off the hook. And I'm looking at these little slips of paper and two of them are, well, some crazy ones that says, my dog was with you 50 years ago. But there were two that said, my brother was with you in the hut, and he doesn't live in Holland anymore, but I'll tell him that you were on the radio. And the other one was even more interesting. It said, Ed, I'm listening to you. I live right around the corner of the radio studio. I was with you in the hut. Come and see me immediately when it's over. So it's over, and Carl and I go around the corner. I ring a doorbell on an apartment, and an enormous woman comes out and throws her arms around me, and buries me in her bosom. And I thought, do I know her? She said, you don't remember me, do you, Ed? I said, no. She said, my name, I kept my secret name, Perk, from the war. I remember you. I was many times in the hut, and I remember you very well. I was a courier for the resistance. I carried weapons and uniforms and all kinds of things. Come into the living room and meet my husband, Lou. And I walk into the living room, and there's a man with silver hair. I immediately recognize him as one of the men I lived with 50 years ago in the hut. And of course, we cried and we hugged and we do. And he said, Ed, did you ever see the photographs I took of you in the hut? I said, are you crazy? You weren't supposed to take any photographs in the hut. If the Gestapo got pictures of them, they knew who we were. He said, well, I don't know. I was an amateur photographer. I got two pictures of you. One, one, both in the hut, one that you stand and you're leaning on this, on the bunk beds where we slept, and the other is where we're sitting behind the long table where we used to drink tea at the night, remember? And somebody would read Dostoevsky out of the book, and they were a very intellectual bunch, you know. I said, yeah, I remember, but he said, wait, I'll get the pictures. I've blown those up on there on the boards. There's a picture of me, 17-year-old, as I always said, that cynical young man in the shorts leaning on those bunk beds, that was me. But I said, and he knew the names of all the people. There we were all sitting, drinking tea, listening to somebody reading. That was our entertainment for the night. And he knew all the names. So I said, Lou, everything is revealed now, except one thing. Who was my buddy? Who was my partner? Who was that man? He said, "Don't you know?"
All you had was a pseudonym. You didn't tell each other your real names. You didn't tell each other your